Hello, this is the Westminster Standard. I'm Ryan Beasy. On the morning of March 26th, 1990, Covenant Seminary student Elizabeth McIntosh was found brutally murdered on the seminary campus. The perpetrator of this vicious and heinous crime against God and one of his children has never been identified. This horrible reality has been a source of lament and grief for many in the seminary community and the Presbyterian Church in America more broadly. And this year, there has been a podcast dedicated to re-examining the murder in hopes of bringing justice for this crime, as well as to reflect upon how the PCA and the leadership of Covenant Seminary have responded to her death and its investigations over the decades. The True Believer podcast has sparked necessary conversations on this subject throughout the Presbyterian Church in America. Today, I am joined by two alumni from Covenant Seminary, as well as two esteemed podcasters who are working on a project related to Covenant Seminary, TJ and Gracia and Ruth Servin-Smith, the host and producer of the True Believer podcast, reflecting on the brutal murder of Elizabeth McIntosh back in 1990 at Covenant Seminary and shedding light on this unsolved injustice on the campus. Nate Zanders, also with us, a returning guest, teaching elder in Tennessee Valley Presbytery, alumnus of Covenant Seminary, along with Charles Stover in Missouri Presbytery, also an alumnus of Covenant Seminary. And I am not an alumnus of Covenant Seminary, but I've reformed in Jackson, but I did live in St. Louis for the first half of my life or so. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Thanks. Ruth and TJ, why don't you give us a little bit of background about yourself and your interest in the PCA? I know you've done that on the podcast.
Ladies first, Ruth.
Okay. As I think we've talked about ourselves enough on our show, but I am a pastor's kid. My dad was a graduate of Covenant Seminary in, I think, 1999. And then he went on to be an RUF minister at the University of Oklahoma, planted a church in Oklahoma City, and is now a pastor out in Maryland. So I grew up in the church, did RUF in school, still attend a PCA church. And by day, I'm a journalist. I lead a team of education journalists in Alabama. We work for AL.com, a big local news organization in Alabama. And our goal is just to produce education news and content that helps kids and families make the best decisions for their communities.
Great. And TJ, people will recognize your voice if they've listened to the podcast as well.
Yes. Okay. So I'm a freelance video producer by trade. I grew up non-denominational evangelical. So the Wild West of American evangelicalism. Went to Christian school for 12 years growing up. That's where I met Kyle Hackman and Andrew Stout, who you heard in the first episode. And it was through Kyle that I got introduced to Elizabeth's case. I had friends and some family who had attended Covenant who had never heard about Elizabeth's murder. So when Kyle first told me about it around 2017 was the first time I'd ever heard about it.
Yeah. Well, on the on your podcast, you some of your guests mentioned there's been a reluctance to talk about this, even perhaps some resistance by the administration. If it's okay, I want to play a few minutes from your show from episode 6 to give folks some background if they haven't heard it yet.
Series and spoken with dozens of people about it. It's amazing how many people connected to Covenant over the last 33 years knew little to nothing about the details, if they even knew a murder happened at all. And for those who did know about Elizabeth, there are lingering questions about how Covenant Seminary may have tried to sweep the murder under the rug and what effects that may have had on Covenant's culture. Now, Doug Servin is a bit of a controversial figure within certain PCA and Covenant circles, and this has led to a lot of people being skeptical about this series. Here's Ruth talking about her dad and his relationship to this project.
And he kept feeling like he was getting shut down by people directly connected to Covenant or who might know something important, and he couldn't get them to tell them what he knew, and so I think he just pushed on it more than people were comfortable. But I do think as he got more invested in this independent project, you know, it really became clear that he needed to either be on part of the project or be on leadership at the seminary. They probably shouldn't both be happening at once. And then it did work out that he left the board of the seminary as this project was really ramping up. So I don't think
you talk about losing your ordination all the time over this. And I mean, as somebody who's not ordained and probably will never be, never will be. And there's such a fear, I think, in a lot of our institutions of the image we're presenting and keeping our vows. And like, those are not unimportant things, but just everything's locked down. Like, we don't talk freely. Like, we can't make mistakes. We can't put out a bad, you know, bad word about something.
Yeah, so I think some of it is institutionally, covenant's not super hyped about this topic, which, of course, but
I do think there is a common sentiment. I think they've used it well here of being careful and respectful. I do think sometimes that can be misused, though, to encourage people not to talk when transparency is needed. And that's really something we've encountered as we've dug through this case.
When you were a student at Covenant, did you have any classes in the chapel basement?
Yes, multiple classes in all of the classrooms in the basement of the chapel. And remember going into that bathroom and kind of, you know, remembering what Dr. Van Groningen had talked about, and, you know, feeling strange and uneasy and just this kind of surreal dynamic, because none of the students that I was in seminary with had heard about this or knew about it, and nobody talked about it. And when I raised it, it was, you know, generally the kind of the posture of the response was of kind of disbelief. And yes, from the administration and from faculty, the most part, it's been, we don't talk about this. And so the impetus, you know, to kind of look into this, you know, even leading to this, you know, podcast has come from various students who've been, you know, come to a place of saying that's not okay. And not just students, but students and their wives who have said, this happened to a woman, to a female student. And it's not okay that this has not been talked about, not been acknowledged. There's been no reference to it. There's no, you know, memorial about it. But you know, that's been a disturbing kind of reality in the lack of dialogue or acknowledgement that this even happened. And so it's been a strange and disturbing reality that this has been kind of a dirty little secret that no one wants to talk about or acknowledge. And so over the past 10 plus years, I have heard from people who have inquired about an investigation that was done, about letters that were written to Michael from the physical plant, about lawyers who were involved, and come to discover that the St. Louis police didn't know about those investigations or didn't know and weren't given the results of those. And so the past 10 plus years, the kind of the revelations of Covenant Seminary doing things under the cover of darkness and not being transparent has been really quite disturbing and disappointing and alarming as someone who believes that God calls us to transparency and to justice.
We talked in episode 4 about Covenant's internal investigation, how their lawyer, Mark Bells, presented a 5-page executive summary to the board, but that the full report and all the investigation files seem to have disappeared. This is only my personal opinion here, and Ruth agrees, but we find it extremely hard to believe that no one at Covenant Seminary, namely President Paul Koistra, Vice President Brian Chapel, or the members of the seminary board, ever saw the full contents of that report.
So that was some of the most powerful audio, I think, so far on your show, especially there with you and Kennedy, and then TJ, as you kind of wrap it up. So, you know, can you walk us through some of the evidence that has led to this conclusion? And I heard a lot of talk about fear, you know, of we're not allowed to talk about this. We can't talk about this. Why is that, do you think?
Bruce?
Well, I'm going to refer back to our reporting a lot of the time because it's not so much our conclusion. It's questions that people have raised that we've talked to. You just ran through a lot of information at double time. So
sorry.
I would encourage people to listen to it at 1x speed. you just ran through a lot of different perceptions. There are perceptions directly of Covenant graduates who've asked questions about this case. And, you know, to back up, I talk about this in the show. My dad is a graduate of Covenant and didn't learn about this murder until about 2020. And then, as he talks about in that clip, he started asking questions and felt like it was hard to really understand just the facts of the case, right, as well as what the seminary had done afterward or might still think about doing in the future. And that's, I would say, a very common sentiment from people. Some people don't fault the seminary at all. Some people think that, well, of course, it's hard to talk about a murder. It's not just something that would come up in the campaign brochures. But generally speaking, it seems because there's nothing in the public record, and that's what this project is trying to correct, it's hard for people to get accurate information about this case. And then it's hard for them to ask questions that might lead to a particular outcome of what the seminary should do. And then bigger picture too, a lot of people express to us kind of a ninth commandment fear that I think is very common in church circles of, I have questions, I want to ask questions, I want to work towards the truth, but I also don't want to be party to misrepresentation. I don't want my voice and my experience to, you know, incorrectly impact someone else. And so how do we navigate that in a responsible manner?
So, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm jumping a little bit ahead here, but it struck me as I was listening. I'm sorry that I didn't think about this before, but it struck me as we were listening to those clips, which, by the way, I've listened to the whole podcast, I think, twice through now. It's very well done. And just trying to figure out what, you know, piecing things together. So I just want to first commend you guys for the excellent work that you've done. But I think one of the battles that we're having in the PCA at large actually applies directly to this Ninth Commandment issue. We're right now struggling in the PCA to decide whether or not we want to be more confessional in terms of how we use the Westminster Standards and the large and shorter catechisms. And I think the problem is not that people have a Ninth Commandment concern. It's that they don't actually understand the teaching of the larger catechisms enough about the Ninth Commandment. Because if you just turn to Westminster Larger Catechism 144, it makes it explicitly clear that part of fulfilling the duties required of the Ninth Commandment are preserving and promoting the truth between man and man and the good name of our neighbor as well as our own. And it goes on to say that part of our duties are love and care for our own good name and defending it when need requireth. Now, I don't speak that way, but that's how they did a few hundred years ago. But I think covenant right now is in, and always probably has been, but more so now than ever, thankfully, because of your podcast, I think there's a need for love and care of their own good name to speak about this issue in addition to doing a lot of the things that have been spoken of by your dad and other men on the podcast about how we properly honor Elizabeth's memory. So has there been, TJ, I think you said something at the end of maybe it was the first episode that certain people are gambling that this all goes away in a month. What, how did you get that impression? Who do you sense is gambling? Was that explicitly stated? Hey, TJ, we think this is all going to blow over and we don't need to talk to you. Like, how did you formulate that opinion?
Sure. Yeah. I wouldn't say that wasn't anybody saying that directly. You know, as we've been sort of ramping up to start producing this series, really it's been years in the making. And so as it's sort of been ramping up, people involved in helping us produce the series, and then just, we have connections at Covenant and other sources. And I would say there's just been a general impression from some people connected to Covenant, connected to the PCA, that, that they'd just rather not talk about this. No, I don't, that's not to say or to imply that there's nefarious intent behind that, there's a box somewhere in Covenant Seminary that has information that would solve the murder and they're just hiding it. And I think what Kyle spoke to in episode 7, this idea of, there's a lot of things are changing in the world. Communication style is changing.
Yeah.
And I think there's a huge generational thing, mm-hmm. a lot of the pushback we've gotten on the series, since we've been producing and even before we released anything for anybody to hear what we were actually doing, there's a pretty clear generational divide in terms of, people who want to talk about it, who want to raise these issues, and people who would rather just not talk about it.
Yeah. It is a very generational thing. I think TJ, I don't know what generation you're in. I'm a millennial. And I think millennials kind of swung to the opposite of the spectrum where it's like, I'm going to share everything all the time with everyone I meet, and which is an overcorrection, but there was in the old guard previous generations, it seems like, we just don't talk about these things. And there's gotta be some way. Like, I think, Doug should have zero concern about losing his ordination over trying to figure out.
Right.
If anybody would insinuate to Doug or communicate to Doug, hey, like, better not, because you could, I think that's absurd. I think there's gotta be a way that we can talk about these things and sort through these things and move forward without teaching elders being worried, am I ever going to be able to come home and get a job closer to home? Or am I going to have to find a new job? I just think there's got to be something we can do. It's not so hush hush. And also not so, let's talk about this murder over, you know, casual brunch like every chance we get. So.
Well, and if I can just say, like, as a framing table setting thing too, our project is not pro or anti Covenant, and it's also not pro or anti PCA. We're approaching this independently. And so our job is to platform people who have experience and important things to say around this case. And then what the PCA decides to do in response to this case is up to y'all. And so I think sometimes there's miscommunications too, that we're advocating for a particular type of response. Really, we're just advocating for response.
Yeah.
And then whatever form that takes is up to people actually operating in the system with the power to make decisions.
Yeah. Ruth, why do you think that there could be a possibility? Like, why do you think people would construe this as being an anti-PCA or anti-Covenant podcast?
Because people say that all the time. I don't know why. We've been as clear as we can be about our intentions. And this is how I operate with every journalism project I do.
I think there's also a predisposition that the press is always anti-establishment, especially when it's not the official press. You know, there's just with, you know, with this podcast, with any number of unofficial PCA podcasts, there's an assumption that we are against Lawrenceville. And I'm speaking of my own personal podcast, not True Believer. And so with y'all coming in and looking at Covenant, there's probably an assumption that, oh, they're going to say things that we're not going to agree with, not going to make us look good. But, you know, I was concerned, you know, when I think it was you and Kennedy had said, you know, we're not allowed to talk about that. Because, you know, I heard about this when I was a student at RTS Jackson from a faculty member who was a Covenant Seminary grad. And, you know, we didn't talk about it, not because we felt, you know, that there was some prohibition on it, but to bring up this would be just poor taste. But I think what your podcast has done is bring sort of an objective journalistic way of looking at this that isn't getting into the politics of the PCA. So I think you've done us a service in that way.
Yeah, we have no interest in getting involved in any, you know, reformed internecine, you know, that's, you guys can handle that. Yeah, we're just trying to report, you know, what people have told us. And that's part of the challenge, is that we can only report things that we get access to and people who will talk to us. And so, you know, there are sides, there are voices we would love to hear from so that they can tell their side of the story. But, you know, thus far we haven't had some of those voices. But yeah, but we're just trying to tell the story as straightforward and truthfully as possible and let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah. You've certainly done that.
Yeah. So one of the things that gets brought up in the podcast is that, you know, there was no one was ever talking about it while this person was interviewed while they're at Covenant and this other person. And it was never brought up in a formal way while I was there from 2011 to 2014. I think I heard of, I can't even remember who told me about it, but it was, I never even really thought much more about it because the way that it was framed in that conversation, because of where the seminary is located, this person was under the impression that it was an outsider, kind of a vagrant wandering in off the two major highways. And it was like, oh, well, that's why it's unsolved. They come in, they find a victim, they, you know, they're unwell or they're, you know, just evil embodied and they leave. So it was kind of like, well, I guess it's just going to remain a mystery. So one of the things I'm thankful for about this podcast is I think it's probably pretty clear that it most likely was someone on campus. And that kind of changes probably a lot of people's understanding of what went down. But I guess, I guess my question is how should, you know, from, you know, the early 90s to 2023, how should have students and prospective students been, how should they have been informed that this is something that happened? You know, is this part of the campus tour? By the way, you know, welcome to the chapel. Someone got killed in 1990 downstairs. We'll talk more later.
That,
you know,
that probably wouldn't have been appropriate. Yeah. No. And actually, yeah. So I think that sometimes there's this false dichotomy between, all the people we've talked to, you know, basically everyone we've talked to has some opinion about either people connected to Covenant who did hear about it, who didn't hear about it. And, you know, in, to be fair to them, in the wake of the murder, there were professors who talked about it occasionally in classes, and there were students mm-hmm. who knew about it, and then many others who didn't. So no one has suggested that, to your point, that it should be in the marketing brochures for Covenant Seminary. Yeah, by the way, when you're here for your tour, check out the murder bathroom in the basement.
Right.
But
it also was never on the other end of the spectrum too, like you're going to get kicked out if you bring this up. So
right. Yeah. There's been no evidence, or no one has told us anything, that there was an explicit prohibition, you know, thou right. shalt not but ever speak of Elizabeth
social
McIntosh.
Pressure type of a thing.
Yeah. I think there was just a general sense of like, this is just something that's not talked about, that we shouldn't talk about. We have never talked about it. So I guess it's just not a thing that we talk about.
Comes up.
So, you know, people have suggested things like, and you've heard, you know, most of this in the series, basically, you know, some kind of memorial or a plaque or a bench with her name on it, or, you know,
scholarship
or scholarship in her name, or some kind of, you know, that's not for us to decide necessarily how Covenant should remember her. But there is some, you know, surely there's something between, and people have suggested things somewhere between showing people the bathroom on the tour and never speaking of it. So somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, if I had shown up in 2012 and then that spring semester, or 2011, and in the spring of 2012, hey, on March 26, we have this special chapel, right? That'd have been like a very normal and natural way to 21 years later, 22 years later, to kind of remember it. And then it's not this big kind of, not secret, but it's not this thing that's unspoken about, and something is being done. And it kind of doesn't feel like this weird story on the tour. And it also isn't saying nothing. So I think, in my opinion, and as a, you know, my hope and plan, I don't know how many people are going to be on board with this, is to Overture General Assembly to instruct Covenant to establish, something like that.
I know that's been talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's time to stop talking about it and just do it. And then
Nate,
also,
are we going to have a called meeting of Tennessee Valley Presbytery to do that?
I mean,
we would have probably, to.
What'd you say?
We would have to, because our next meeting is 29 days before GA convenes.
Well,
so if
it probably won't be something on the GA docket for this year.
Okay.
But one way or the other, I mean, this isn't the last GA ever.
But I think another year goes by.
Yeah. I also think that the seminary, from what I can see, has responded to alumni. When alumni kind of in chorus and unison say, this is something we want to see. I think that's probably the first step, is to relational. That's probably the more, it's less institutional, more relational, to just kind of have whatever alumni are willing to say, hey, this is what we'd like to see, you know? Because it's not about condemning the lack of action in the last 30 years. It's about, you know, doing what we can to rightly preserve the memory of this, and also to continually cry out to God for justice. Because at this point, it kind of feels like it's going to take the help of the Lord to figure out who did this. And to bring about some degree of civil justice this side of eternity. So, anyway,
one other thing I've discussed with people too, Nate, is it's not just about Elizabeth McIntosh's memory and the murder itself. This case is mostly discussed in, you know, party conversations after a few beers, discussions in passing with some people who've heard things secondhand and third hand. I'm not saying that anybody did anything wrong or was malicious in how they gossiped, but then those stories have come back to TJ and I and have been wrong. And that means that people's names have been brought up with incorrect information attached to them. And so part of what this project is trying to do, again, as much as possible, we've contacted over 100 people to say, what did you do? What do you remember? Do your memories check out with this police report? And so again, you know, it's natural for people to talk. It's natural. I'm not saying every story was wrong or wrong on purpose, but when there's no public record getting as close to the truth as it can, it does have real damage sometimes on people's reputations. And I would point out that justice has not been done on Elizabeth McIntosh's name, but justice may have been left undone on suspects connected to this case, because it probably can only be one person and there are multiple people frequently brought up. And so what we're also trying to do is see if we can help someone or their family get out from under this as well.
Yeah. I know you mentioned, I think on the show, one of the main suspects, the family said, as soon as there's a conviction of the one who did it, we'll be the first to talk. But right now we can't, since we are constantly being asked. And I was just researching for this this week, and there was an article from a year ago saying so-and-so, I'm not going to mention his name, but so-and-so is expected to be charged by the state very soon. Well, that was a year ago.
Yeah.
And you know, that poor man, every time someone does a Google search for his name.
And I just want to point out, if I could step in here, I think it's to sort of piggyback off what Nate said earlier. I think it's a shame that we have to wait for a podcast like this, an excellent podcast, to come up and to bring this issue to the forefront before we begin to lament and to mourn the silence that there's been for Elizabeth and Covenant's response. I think that's been my greatest takeaway, is just, man, every time I hear an episode, I want to mourn for Elizabeth and her family. And the fact that it takes a podcast like this to really, to get elders to be motivated to overture the General Assembly to get Covenant to do something, I think is damning for us. And we need to mourn and lament that. So I just want to say thank you, TJ, Ruth, for the excellent work that you've put into the podcast. I mean that sincerely. One of the things, I think, you know, if I were to offer critique or suggest anything, not that I'm in a position to do that, but one of the problems, that quote-unquote problems, that I've had with the podcast is one of the beauties of Covenant Seminary, and I was a student there from 18 to 21 and a staff member. I worked with Andrew, by the way, TJ.
Okay.
So we're friends. But one of the things that's great about Covenant is that they've really held on to their faculty and staff. So many of the faculty members that were there in the 80s and 90s are still there today, or they were there just a few years ago when I was there. So you have very long tenured faculty and staff members who have been there for a long time, or they're recently retired. Most of the faculty at Covenant, I believe, were former students or graduates of the seminary. And I've heard many of my former colleagues and friends and professors interviewed on the podcast, and they've made suggestions by way of memorializing Elizabeth and how to celebrate her. And I don't want to impugn motives or anything like that, but the natural question that comes up is, why now? You know, you've been involved with the seminary for 2-3 decades, and we're just now talking about these things. And I don't want to, you know, I know the importance, and I know the power differentials and how strong institutional silence can be, but I just really would encourage elders, faculty members, staff members at Covenant, people close to St. Louis as I am, if you have concerns, go directly to the source, go to the board, go to the president. And I'm not saying that they haven't. I'm just saying that this is the natural question that comes up in my mind, is I've noticed in Reformed circles that we tend to talk in circles, that instead of going to people directly, we'll post about it online, we'll blog about it, we'll podcast about it, but we won't go to the source. And we're kind of hoping our suggestions and our criticisms reaches their ears. So I would hope that the people that you guys have interviewed have done that, have made their suggestions. And I have no reason to doubt that they haven't, but It's just natural for me to think, okay, you've been involved with the seminary for 40 years. And I'm not thinking of just one person in particular. I hope that you've been sharing your concerns, these suggestions, to the appropriate courts and to the appropriate people. I know that's a long-winded question, answer, statement, but if you could speak more to that, I'd appreciate it.
In terms of Ruth and I making those suggestions, or
what have members of the faculty who have been there since the 90s or even late 80s, what have they done before you knocked on their doors and said, hey, what about this? Why was there no outcry for justice in 1991, 92?
Well, hang on. I don't think participating in a podcast is the only way of an outcry of justice.
Absolutely not. But from what these two alumni have said, there really wasn't much official memory of Elizabeth.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what those specific voices that you've heard, what they may or may not have done previously.
I don't know. Yeah,
there's no, that hasn't really been a part of, digging into what they, each one of them specifically has done. And I think, I can't speak for everyone. I'm not inside everyone's minds and know what they're thinking, but I think this may have been in one of the bonus content episodes, the conversation between Ruth and I, where I talked about how, I think it's not that there's any nefarious motives here, or right, that things were, that people put on black robes and they conspire to cover up the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh. I think it's more, Ruth used the phrase institutional inertia. It sort of began as this, we don't know how to talk about this. It's uncomfortable to talk about it. It might, people are going to think bad about the seminary if we talk openly about it. And so that the cake kind of starts to get baked, mm-hmm, and then decades go by and it's never been talked about. So people don't talk about it.
Yeah.
People have also told us that they trusted the police process, mm-hmm, and didn't know until they heard our interview with the police that the police didn't feel like they had all of the information.
Yeah. And it was interesting to hear. Well, let me first say that, TJ, what you were just talking about, I think the way you put it, black robes, cabal, I really appreciated that. I really appreciated that part of the podcast, because that's my assumption as well. This is not some sort of malicious, nefarious thing. And once again, institutional inertia, I think that's a great phrase. And what I hope that this podcast does is that it causes everybody in the kitchen, so to speak, is to go, hey, let's get this cake out of the oven. We can't just keep letting it bake. We have to do something. And now's a good opportunity for us to do something. So I do want to say that I appreciated that. And that was it's a very important takeaway, I think, for people to have as they listen to the podcast.
Charles, would you be willing to overture your presbytery to send up an overture to General Assembly, suggesting things that Covenant might do? I mean, we keep talking about things that we would like to see happen. But as far as I know, there's no one who's overtured the assembly to act. And coming from Missouri Presbytery would be very fitting. Is it something you'd consider doing?
It would certainly be something I would consider doing. I would hope that Covenant would take the initiative and do something. But I want to be careful with my words here. I would much rather them lead rather than the General Assembly overture or be overtured into making a decision. However, I also recognize that it's been 33 years. So, this is a tricky situation.
For what it's worth, I think my dad is considering an overture.
Good. And, it would be wonderful if there were multiple overtures, but, it's easy to come on a podcast, but it's harder to work through the church courts. And, as much as we do want Covenant to take the lead, also our agency should be led by the General Assembly. And so I don't think it'd be inappropriate for any presbytery to send up an overture saying Covenant Seminary is directed to do X, Y, and Z to honor the memory of Elizabeth McIntosh. What do you think the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh may indicate about the PCA at that time, and then any ongoing issues? I want to play a short clip this time from, I think her name was Brittany, who talked about that.
Can you do it at one time speed?
I can do it at 1.5.
Okay.
But these are all from episode 6.
I think what kind of brings me around towards being willing to
have a microphone in your
have
face.
A microphone in front of my face and talk about it with you guys is the hope that while being careful not to make this its own form of exploitation, there is something about Elizabeth's story and this murder happening at Covenant Seminary's campus, her being a single older woman and, you know, not knowing anything about her as a person. You know, almost everything we know at this point still is pretty speculative because we didn't know her and everything's from so long ago. It still paints such an interesting picture when you understand the context of the PCA and what it means to be a woman in the PCA, especially a woman who attends seminary in the PCA or who feels called or interested or gifted for ministry. And
especially
so,
outspoken ones.
Especially outspoken ones who don't fit a certain mold or who, yeah, you just can't fit in a box. So,
which is you.
Sure. Yes. There's a little bit of identification with her, curiosity about that. But it's more than just her and who she is as a person, but also like the way she was treated, right? And the way her death was treated by the seminary or by the people in her community. And the fact that it's just not talked about in a way that gives honor to her as having dignity as a person and that she lived and died with us and seeking justice for her. So that's kind of where I've landed.
So what do you think, can you elaborate on your own thoughts as to what this might say about the PCA then and now almost 34 years later?
Ruth, I'll defer to you.
You know, we do address the dynamics of Covenant as a seminary and the PCA as a denomination and the interplay between the two. We covered the split between Covenant and Knox seminaries at the same time. But I don't think this project is very much about what was happening in the PCA in 1990. I don't have any indication that her murder was political in nature or that the seminary's response was particularly political in nature. What people have mostly told us is just that the murder of a female student was really important and that it deserves more attention now. It's not that it was inadequately handled at the time, but just that it is a piece of the pie. And some people have made allegations that like gender and theology are connected. This podcast is not trying to make that allegation ourselves.
But you did an entire episode. I mean, episode 7. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but like, I'm trying to understand how you square what you're saying with the fact that you did an entire episode on it.
Right? No, we did an entire episode on why people were feeling pressure to talk about or not talk about this issue.
So that's how you would characterize episode 7.
I think so. TJ, do you want to weigh in?
Are there more dots you want to connect there in terms of anything specific about episode 7 that you have in mind there that you want to, it might be easier
I think for a lot of us that have appreciated the podcast, I thought episode 7 kind of jumped the shark where it was like, hey, we're, you know, and to answer the reason I asked you that question previously, Ruth, is because, I mean, it's probably 30 minutes ago now, but it's precisely because of episode 7 that when you guys say this is not a hit job on the PCA, we have no agenda. It's precisely because of episode 7 that a lot of people that were tracking with you up until that episode are going, this kind of feels like disconnected from the rest of the content. And it feels like they just wanted to talk about this. Like it doesn't seem to several who have been following along that there is a natural flow. And so that's why, you know, that's why I bring this up, is because it seems like there's a particular perspective on other matters. And it was an opportunity to head down that rabbit trail, to head down that lane and talk about those things, particularly the way that women are treated or allowed to say certain things, hold office, teach formally or informally, et cetera. It seemed like that was, that was heavily featured in that episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did that episode because the previous episode was sort of about people more directly connected to Covenant, what they had heard, what they had not heard, the sense of it not being talked about. We don't talk about it. And then I think we felt like it was important to zoom out, you know, so Elizabeth is at Covenant Seminary. So she's in this context of this seminary that is in a wider context of the PCA. So we wanted to talk about, you know, hear some voices who have raised issues about some of those things and to hear perspectives on if some of those things are connected. Now, we're not advocating for any certain theological position, the ordination of women, you know, that's outside the scope of what we're doing. We heard from some of those voices, and we felt like if we were going to talk about issues that are going on in the PCA now that may be connected to the culture and the people who were dealing with the issue of Elizabeth's murder in 1990 and what connections that might be, you know, we wanted to hear some of those personal stories. We heard from Liam Adams, who's done reporting on recent issues in the PCA and those things. And so, yeah, I mean, I would say more or less, I think the episode, as far as Ruth and I are concerned, sort of speaks for itself in terms of, you know, especially Liam's ending soundbite in terms of, you know, the guys who came out of Covenant, they came out of this culture in 1990 who were around at the time of the murder. And some sort of the, we'll call it some of the pushback we've received in trying to produce this series and get access to information and speak to people and what connections there might be to some of those other issues. But yeah, we're not advocating for any position or I'm not a part of the PCA, never been in the PCA. So I'm agnostic to all of those kinds of
things. Understood. Yeah. So I think I guess something I'd like to address then about that is that it's interesting because well, let me just ask a question instead. What is your understanding in terms of Covenant's relationship in the PCA with all the other seminaries when it comes to the relevant theological positions or practices within the church? What's your understanding of where Covenant falls on those issues that were represented and discussed in episode 7, even if those things were tertiary?
I would say for the purposes of our podcast, it's those the Covenant's connection to other seminaries or theological differences are irrelevant as far as we're concerned for telling that story.
Yeah, I don't agree with that at all. I think it's highly interesting that you know, that there's this split between Covenant and Knox, and Knox is at the time more conservative. I think it's highly relevant that the seminary that's reputation has become that on the scale of, you know, I think it was Doug, your dad, who came up with this, Ruth, but 9.2 to 9.7, right? So that's a way of insider baseball talk for, you know, the grand scheme of evangelicalism, the most progressive guy in the PCA is still a 9.2 out of 10 in terms of being conservative. And then the most conservative would be 9.7. I would quibble with him and say it's probably more like 8.0 or 8.2 to 9.7, but you get what I'm driving at. Covenant is known for pumping out guys in the PCA who fall in more of that, you know, in Doug's categories, 9.2 realm, right? They're the guys that are more likely to say women should be deaconesses. Women should be doing more formal teaching. They're the kind of guys who, you know, who want that to be part of more normal and widespread in the PCA. So I find it really interesting.
Why do you feel like that's relevant to the murder investigation, though?
Well, I think it's relevant to not so much the murder investigation, but the institutional silence, the institutional inertia, as you put it. I thought it was just an interesting avenue to be explored because the way that, in my opinion, the way that episode 7 unfolds, there's this. You know, there's this conversation about the PCA as a whole, but it never seems to be explored that that the people that were quiet about this, the people that were the regime, so to speak, that was in control of that institution in the 90s, it was not the more conservative men. It was actually the more progressive men that were remaining. Because oftentimes the way that it's in the broader PCA world, the way that abuse is spoken of and the way that silencing those who are abused, it's often talked about as if the progressives in our denomination are the champions of those people. But these conservative confessionals over here just don't really care as much as these guys do.
I think I would dispute your premise because I have not heard conservative voices speaking about the murder either.
Right. But my point was, is that there was, once again, we're using the 9.2 to 9.7. So we're all pretty conservative, right? But on that scale, who was in control of the institution that was quiet?
Yeah, Nate, I mean, I think you're making a political argument about whether the progressive wing of the PCA handled this murder correctly. And
I will let you make that argument.
I'm more interested in how people responded directly to the murder itself. And so we have talked to people on campus at the time, and we've tried to talk to lots more people who were on campus at the time. I can't speak for every person who's decided not to talk with us. People certainly, some have very good reasons for not wanting to talk. I would not necessarily say that not wanting to talk can then be extrapolated onto every issue touching women in the PCA or progressives in the PCA.
But you have done a good bit of backstory on women in the PCA. And I think even you said that it was necessary to understand women in the PCA in order to get a fuller understanding of the events around her murder and then Covenant's response, which I think is where Nate is coming from. And then to understand, you referenced a, I don't know if you called it a battle or a turning point at Covenant Seminary shortly before she was murdered, in which the more confessional, old school cadre of the seminary was forced out, and Paul Koistra and Brian Chappell were elevated to positions of leadership and still leaders in the PCA. So I think maybe Nate's question stems from, how do you think that impacted the background of the change that had recently been, I think, completed by 1990? Into the way the institution responded to her murder. Is that what you were getting at, Nate?
Yeah, I'm just getting at the point that I think it is that the silence is out of step with, has been out of step with the rest of, with all these other elements. And I think it's a shame. And I think it's also, it was worth exploring. And to me, it just seemed like it was, I think because of my time in the PCA, that was something that I connected right away, is that there's, we often hear this at General Assembly, and then yet, the same kind of ethos over here wasn't handling this maybe the way that would be more consistent with, with the overall.
I understand what you're saying, and I don't mind the critique at all. TG and I can consider whether we should address that in future episodes. I will just say, though, that I don't think it's as easy as a binary between how a liberal would address a tragedy in a church and how a conservative would address a tragedy in a church, and how people address things in 1990 might not be how they talk about them today.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's, again, that's why
we, from my perspective, there are no liberals in the PCA. We have conservatives.
I mean, we agree.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's no theological liberals in the PCA.
So if people take issue with how Paul Koistra and Brian Chappell handled this, that's fine. And if people want to come on our show and talk about how they think that might impact how leaders in the church, including Koistra and Chappell, address issues today, that's fine. But we did make a choice in this episode, in this project, that while we did want to do one big zoom out episode, we did not want to get dragged into litigating every issue that the PCA is dealing with today. So we were trying to thread the needle of how do we talk about these broader issues that a lot of people brought up without getting dragged into a tit for tat over tons of individual issues that plenty of ink has been spilled over.
Yeah. And I think it's also worth saying there's no one that we've spoken to in terms of the response in 1990 and, you know, maybe in the immediate years following, no one has indicated anything like because of specific theological beliefs, you know, whether there was a 9.2 to 9.7, that influenced the decision in any way, that, you know, if it had been a male student, for example, would the response have been different? Or if the, you know, if the guys who left to start Knox Seminary, if they had won that quote unquote battle, you know, would the response have been different? We haven't heard anyone say, you know, that strongly that they think one way or another. And I think what's as much or the more interesting, not question, but just sort of, just what's so interesting is that on the 9.2 to 9.7 scale, Elizabeth would have been about a 9.9.
That's right.
And so she was aligned with that much. She was transferring to Knox Seminary for a semester. So that's another interesting, and it doesn't seem, you know, there's no evidence that she was going to Knox because she was unhappy with anything theologically or specifically about covenant.
And, that's right.
And the police got mixed up about that too. They had a theory that somebody killed her because she was going from a more conservative to a more progressive institution. Right. And of course we all know that it was in fact the exact opposite.
Yeah.
So, you know, that churches are complicated. Internal politics are complicated.
Yeah. Well, as we kind of wrap up, can you give us a preview of the trajectory of where the podcast will go? I know, you know, we've had some concerns, some compliments, criticisms. So obviously it's I'm sure in flux, but can you tell us where it might go in future episodes?
Sure. Well, yeah, from this point forward, we're more or less back into the inner workings of the investigation and some of the characters who were involved in 1990. I think at the end of the last episode, I teased, so I can say the next episode is going to be focusing on the main suspect, Michael, and his interactions with Covenant Seminary. He ended up taking a polygraph test that is going to be the main focus of this upcoming episode. And then we're going to talk about some other suspects. We're going to talk about some other characters who were around the orbit of Covenant Seminary in 1990, their connections to the case, some troubling things about some people who were around the orbit then. There's other police, at least one other police interview from somebody who worked the case subsequent to 1990. And some of those things. So more back into the internal, you know, the investigation and the characters directly involved in 1990.
Yeah. TJ, is there one of my favorite parts, I think, of the podcast was just I think you do a great job of telling the story, both of you, piecing things together, but it would be fascinating if there could be a collaboration with like a visual artist to kind of go with the audio that you've already produced of the timeline of people's movements in the chapel. I mean, that bit alone was just so valuable, I think, in helping clear up so much of the confusion and misnomers about what happened that day and everything else. So I just, you know, keep going with the quality of the content, man. It's been, you know, both of you have just done a great job of researching this and, you know, trying to piece together the facts so that people can actually understand what happened rather than just wildly speculating with friends while they throw darts, you know?
Thank you. Yeah. And if anybody has those, the skill set to wants to do an animation for that segment of the podcast, we'd love to talk to them. If they're willing to donate their time, we have no budget.
Right.
Well, where can they find you on the internet? Oh, were you going to say something, Charles?
Well, yeah, I have one other thing to add. Oh, yeah. You know, this is still being actively reported out as well. Right. So it's not like we have a story arc that we're going towards, but it's not all of the work is set in stone. I mentioned we've probably tried to reach out to more than 100 people. We've probably interviewed dozens, some on the record, some off. People have brought us leads with new information. We will publish those if and when we feel like we can responsibly do that. And so I would encourage anybody who thinks they know something useful to reach out to us. We may direct them to police. We may not, just depending on what it is. But would certainly encourage anyone with questions or information to reach out.
And where can folks find you? You have your website and then socials.
Yeah, truebelieverpodcast.com. You can find the site and get links to all, you know, wherever you can find podcasts. There, you know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere else you can find it.
All right. And then Ruth, your Twitter handle is there on the screen. TJ, are you on the social?
I have an account so that I can look at other people's. Barely. But I post on Twitter about once every 10 years. So not much.
Smart of him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for giving us some time and raising awareness about this very important concern in the PCA that has gone overlooked for going on 34 years now. So thank you both.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye. Yep.
Thanks for joining the conversation on the Westminster Standard, which is the podcast of Jude 3. For additional resources or to make a donation, visit our website, jude3pca.org. We have started a fortnightly distribution schedule for the Westminster Standard podcast. And so in 2 weeks, please come back as we welcome teaching elders Ben Ratliff and Nate Zanders to consider how the proliferation of Presby media in the form of podcasts and blogs has impacted the Presbyterian Church in America over the last decade or so. I'll talk to you then.